Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the Jewish Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Moses Lappin, and today I'm joined by Professor Ada Rappaport-Albert to discuss two of her recent books. The first, Hasidic Studies, Essays in History and Gender, published by Lippmann Library of Jewish Civilization in 2018. And the second is Women and the Messianic Heresy of Shabtai Tzvi, 1666 to 1816, also published by Lippmann in 2011. Professor Rappaport-Albert is Professor Emerita of Hebrew and Jewish Studies at University College London. She's written prolifically about the social and cultural history of Hasidism and has been a trailblazer in gender history and method as well. Our first topic of conversation today, Hasidic Studies, Essays in History and Gender, is a collection of her essays over the span of 40 years that challenges many of the received doctrines about the history of Hasidism, its origins, the evolving nature of its structure, its leadership, and perhaps most controversially, the role of women in the movement. Today, we will have a chance to look back at her career and better understand her intervention. The second volume under discussion today is her book, Women and the Messianic Heresy of Shabtai Tzvi, originally published in Hebrew. The book is a wonderful study of the life and afterlife of the Messianic movement that arose around Shabtai Tzvi in the 17th and 18th centuries, and the nature of heresy, mysticism, and community in the modern period. Here, women act as a key to the movement as a whole and in understanding the relationship to normative Judaism. The two books are linked, not only thematically, but by a methodological sophistication and sensitivity as well. Professor Rappaport-Albert presents a perspective deeply embedded in primary sources that shines new light on modern Jewish history, and I'm delighted to have her with us today. Welcome, Ada, to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Hello.
So I would like to begin with the first book, your collections of essays, and perhaps begin with a general question. What is Hasidism?
I think one could say that Hasidism began as a phenomenon and was eventually transformed into a movement. I mean, we often think of it as a movement as if it came into the world as such. But in fact, it was a cluster of charismatic individuals endowed with certain gifts that were recognized by the people around them, who responded by affiliating themselves with them. And these people had a message that spiritualized the experience of religious life for a Jew in a way that was informed by the Kabbalistic tradition, but departed from it in as much as in contrast to the rather reclusive tendency of most of the Kabbalists at the time and the esoteric nature of the whole discipline, they functioned in the middle of society. I mean, they were out and about preaching in the street. We have descriptions of the Baal Shem Tov actually standing effectively in the marketplace and telling parables. And they were attracting people's response. It took another, at least, I would say, 30 years, perhaps more, for the first signs of any kind of institutionalization that resulted in what finally, in the course of the 19th century, became a mass movement. So I would say a movement of spiritual revival would be perhaps the best phrase to capture it.
You've begun telling us a little bit about the origins there of the movement. Could you set out a sort of periodization? The first essay in your book is entitled Hasidism After 1772, and is in a sense a discussion of this shift into what would become a movement. So can you set out for us what you would think of as the periodization or the narrative of the movement in the 18th and 19th centuries?
Exactly, yeah. I would say that it begins, and we don't know exactly when it begins. We have a serious problem, of course, with the sources for the very beginning of Hasidism. We have virtually nothing that dates from the period of the events being referred to. But basically, the Baal Shem Tov, who is considered the founder of the movement and who certainly didn't have it in his head that he was founding any movement, was born at the turn of the 17th and 18th century, 1699, 1700. And he is said to have revealed himself publicly at the age of 36. So we can probably assume that the Baal Shem Tov began to be noticed and to appear in public at some point in the 1730s. He is said in the legendary biography or hagiography of the Baal Shem Tov, he's said to have spent his earlier life in seclusion and shunning the public and concealing his spiritual insights. So let us say from some point in the 30s, during the 40s, he becomes known to the people who come in contact with him. We also know that he spent the last 20 years of his life, that is from 1740 until 1760, in the town of Medjibuzh, where we have a very nice detailed study of the nature of the town and his position in it by Moshe Rossman, who discovered a reference to the house in which he lived in Medjibuzh from an entirely independent Polish archival source. So this is one of the very few external confirmation that we have of the very existence of the Baal Shem Tov from his own time. So let us say the Baal Shem Tov becomes known as a Baal Shem, as a healer, as a magician, and also evidently as a spiritual mentor to people from the 40s to his death in 1760. And contemporaneous with him, there's a whole group of people who have traditionally been described as his disciples, when the model that shaped people's thinking about it was very much the model of the much later Hasidic court, with a Rebbe, the Tzaddik, at the center, and a whole group of subservient disciples around him. We now know that these people were colleagues. In a few cases, we know that they were rivals, similar characters, similarly endowed with charismatic gifts, who had their own circles, each their own circles of associates. And sometimes there was tension between rival groups. At any rate, to think of this as the first generation of Hasidism is somewhat misleading, because the man who normally signifies the second generation, that is the Maggid of Mezrich, was almost a contemporary. And it is very difficult, and he is said to have approached the Baal Shem Tov or become acquainted with the Baal Shem Tov towards the end of the Baal Shem Tov's life. So these generations really overlap to a considerable extent. And the Maggid of Mezrich becomes a charismatic figure and a leader to a group of his own associates in much the same way as the Baal Shem Tov did at the beginning. Some of his own disciples begin to run their own Hasidic kind of centers and attract pilgrims, attract followers, even in his own lifetime. So there isn't a clear-cut progression, as if the leadership was transmitted from a founder to a successor and finally to a group of successors, as was commonly believed after the death of the Maggid of Mezrich in 1772. I mean, this is a very artificial and anachronistic construction of the early beginnings. What happens, I think, is that in 1772, and that is why the first paper in this book, which was written many years ago, takes 1772 as a turning point. It is at that point that Hasidism first encounters opposition. That is when the mitnagdim, the opponents, first launch a campaign designed to eradicate the movement. And so it is at this point that Hasidim, the group of leaders, probably not all of them, we know only of those associated specifically with the Maggid of Mezrich, come together and begin to have a sense of being a group that is perceived by hostile outsiders as a dangerous movement, as a sect. So this is the beginning of any kind of a sense of a common cause. And it is from this period on, really, that Hasidism developed its own sense of its own existence as a movement. It constructs its own history. It establishes the Baal Shem Tov as the great founder. And it is from then on that we have a sense of a movement that has a kind of mechanisms for transmitting authority from one generation to the next, and a tremendous proliferation within the next 50 years or so.
Before we return to the sources, which presents obviously a great challenge in telling the history of Hasidism, and is one of the themes of your work and of this collection of essays, I would like to talk a little bit about the leadership structure and the relationship between elite and populace, which is also the theme of one of your essays in the volume. So can you describe a little bit about after the Baal Shem Tov, during the period of the Maggid of Mezrich and later on, what was the nature of the relationship between the leadership and the followers in Hasidism and the nature of the relationship between the elite and the populace?
Again, here we have to start with another myth that has to be debunked, and that is the myth that Hasidism emerges as a as an anti-establishment movement, as a kind of an eruption of popular forces against a fossilized and rather corrupt elite. Nothing is further from the truth. We know that the Baal Shem Tov, again, as Rossmann has shown from that little nugget of information contained in the Polish archives, he was a functionary of the Kahal, of the community. He was paid a salary by the Kahal. In other words, he himself belonged to the elite group. In one of my papers, which was written long before Rossmann's discovery, I argued that the Baal Shem Tov was, and this is perhaps unfair in that it is somewhat negative, I don't mean it as a value judgment, but he was a bit of a social climber, if you like, inasmuch as it is clear from the legends about him, whether they have a kernel of truth in them or not is debatable. But my own sense is that the legendary biography, Shifrei HaBesh, actually retains quite a lot of historical information, sometimes incidentally, because that's not its purpose. But we can, I think, work on the assumption that the Baal Shem Tov, as described in it, truly does aspire to be recognized by the elitist circle of pre-Bastian Hasidic Kabbalists, such as the circle in Brody. For him, that is recognition. Which he doesn't easily get. According to the legend, he does get it very easily by proving that his understanding of the Gemara, which is inspired, it is not a cerebral, analytical argument that he manages to defeat the others by, but rather by a spiritually acquired insight. Nevertheless, they all recognize his true stature. But it is clear that that was a model of an elitist group of Kabbalists that the Hasidim and the Baal Shem Tov certainly is close to, but not a natural part of, but nevertheless recognizes as a valid elitist framework. And my sense is that Hasidism from the very beginning makes a very clear distinction between the inspired charismatic leaders who are a different level of a different level of evolution even. They are different from ordinary people. They have certain properties that other people will never have, however hard they would work on it. and the ordinary people whom they offer themselves as, to whom they offer themselves as intermediaries. In other words, that experience of direct encounter with God, which the charismatic leaders are capable of, can be indirectly shared with ordinary people. And that, after all, is the winning formula. That is the message that attracts people to these Hasidic leaders. They are transported, they are transformed as a result of their contact with the Hasidic leaders, who serve as the intermediaries between this world and the other, between earth and heaven, between their own ordinariness and the supernatural dimension of the leaders, who are able to lead them into a range of spiritual experiences that they would never be able to achieve directly by themselves. So the elitism, I think, is built into it, despite statements that you occasionally do come across that encourage the ordinary person to work as hard as possible on his own spiritual development, on the assumption that they might be able to achieve the same level as the leader. This is a kind of a deductive device, I think, that occasionally appears, as I try to suggest, even in the writings of a Hasidic leader such as Nachman of Breslov, who is one of the most extreme cases of a kind of a unique elitist consciousness of an individual who believes that he's not only a different human being, a different kind of constitution of the human being in relation to all ordinary people, but also to all other Hasidic leaders, and even going back to the historical past, all the great personalities of the Jewish historical past. So he has a very clear sense of his own uniqueness and his own superiority. And nevertheless, occasionally you find statements that would appear to invite the ordinary person to strive hard in order to achieve his own level. But I think the deep structure is very much an elite, a very powerful, spiritually powerful elite, who make themselves available to ordinary people with the invitation to join in the experience at their level.
Hasidism is often described as a popular movement or something that's folkish and open or egalitarian to everybody. So I was wondering if you can describe where you think this misconception arose, and also what then was the role of the Hasidim themselves, the followers of the Tzaddik or Rebbe?
Okay. I think the myth begins with a certain strand of the historiography that began from a very hostile posture, I think, in the 19th century, dismissing Hasidism as a vulgar, popular, ignorant, regressive growth within a Judaism which was set on the path of progress. You only have to look at what the great German Jewish historian Goetz had to say about the Baal Shem Tov in a chapter in which he juxtaposes Mendelssohn and the Baal Shem Tov. Mendelssohn representing light, the Baal Shem Tov representing darkness. I mean, there's a certain measure of German Jewish superiority towards Eastern European Jewry as a whole. But Hasidism is really the worst manifestation of that. So there is a certain distaste for Hasidism that tends to color the characterization of the movement as something that only the ignorant masses could come up with, and all the Hasidic leaders are put in the same basket as everybody else, who is rough, uneducated, crass, vulgar, and so on. On top of that, you have in the early 20th century a number of historians who were analyzing the movement with the tools of dialectical materialism, and Mahler is the one who is more often cited than anybody else as an example of this, for whom Hasidism is really an eruption of the proletariat against the rather corrupt and oppressive rabbinic leadership of the Jewish community. So here you have this perception of the popular and vulgar nature of the movement turned upside down in terms of value judgment. It is viewed as a positive force, but it is a force that originates in the common people, as it were. And I think even later than that, in the more recent scholarship, there are a number of people who are viewing Hasidism in the context of mysticism in general as a phenomenon that eradicates boundaries. It is a kind of a liberating experience that flattens out hierarchical divisions, and so God is available everywhere to everyone, at any time, to everyone equally, which is not what I get from the Hasidic texts as I read them. My sense is that although you could say that the message of Hasidism, if there is a single message, because it's a very varied and complex phenomenon, that one of the essential messages is the availability, the immanence, the presence of God in the world, the fact that God has revealed himself in the world, you only have to have the right eye to recognize it, I still think that there are people who have one kind of an eye and there are others who have another. So there were several factors that contributed to the view of Hasidism as essentially and originally a popular movement. It suddenly becomes a popular movement because it is extremely successful. And in the course of the 19th century, I would say by the middle of that century, it certainly is. We don't have numbers. It is very difficult to be sure. There are some pioneering studies being done now, notably by Marcin Wojcinski, a number of others, who are trying to remap the Hasidic movement and to try to get a sense of its demographic development. But we're still rather hazy about that. You know, you have traditional maps of Hasidism that have dots marking Hasidic centers, but that center, we don't know how many Hasidim there were in it. All we know is that a particular Hasidic leader may have lived there for a while and had a court, but his court could have been enormous or it could have been very small. And apart from impressionistic descriptions of size, we really don't have a clear idea. So it becomes a popular movement is beyond any doubt, and there are kind of regions that are apparently predominantly Hasidic. But the picture is much more variegated, and we are still at the beginning of the effort to try and map it out more accurately.
You mentioned Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah. What was the relationship between Hasidism and Kabbalah?
That's a very complex question, partly because Hasidism is so diverse. So some of them have left us a lot of teachings. Others have left practically nothing. Those who have left us teachings have left us really an indirect record of what they actually said, because most of the Hasidic teachings that we have originate in the form of orally delivered sermons, which were transcribed usually after the event, because they were usually delivered on Shabbat or on festivals. So written down from memory by disciples who recorded them. Very few of them had the slightest interest in actually writing down what they taught. So we have transcriptions, which are also translations from the language of discourse, which would have been in the sermon Yiddish, although a lot of quotations from the sources in Hebrew and Aramaic, translations and transcriptions, very far removed from the original sayings as they came out on the occasion on which the sermons were delivered. Still, that's the best we have. And from what we have, we suddenly get the impression that some Hasidic leaders were extremely well informed Kabbalistically. Others, we can't tell. And there were a few who actually were Kabbalists and produced Kabbalistic works quite apart from the kind of sermons they gave to their crowd of disciples. But what they're doing with the Kabbalistic language, symbolism, imagery that they use is ultimately to translate it to another idiom, the Hasidic idiom. So it is Kabbalah translated to something else. And perhaps the best area in which this is evident is the question of what to do with the Kabbalistic tradition of meditations during prayer, which we normally call Kavanot, developed by the Kabbalists already in the Middle Ages, but reaching a kind of a complex and rich state in Safed, associated with the name of the Ari. And these appeared as little indications of where to pause in the middle of the service and what to meditate on particular words, particular letters, particular parts of the text of the liturgy, which means that you are actually reading the text in a completely different way. Kabbalistically, you are not paying much attention to the semantics. You are focusing on the shape and the structure of sentences and words and using them as opportunities for meditation on particular aspects of the Godhead. So these Kavanot, which were extremely complex and difficult to master, are actually abandoned by the Hasidim. We also know Moshe Idel has shown that there was a kind of a retreat from them because they were considered too complex, too difficult to master, and therefore too liable to be wrongly used by people who are not fully in control of the system. And the consequences of wrong Kavanot could be quite catastrophic in cosmic terms. And so there was a tendency beyond Hasidism to withdraw from that practice. What the Hasidim do, they don't abandon the concept of Kavanah. On the contrary, it is very prominent. But the Kavanot, as we can see them being practiced by the Hasidim, are much simpler. Basically, you no longer are concerned to be completely at home with a map of the divine, as the Kabbalists have it, the different aspects of the divine and the interaction between them and the flow of energy from one to the other. You're basically trying to break into the divine realm by force, by emotional force, by spiritual force. This is captured beautifully in a statement recorded in the name of the Maggid of Mezrich several times and then keeps appearing in the writings of his disciples or in the teachings of his disciples. But none of them can be said to have been the writer of what we have. And this is the analogy that he offers to a person who is trying to enter a certain door, to get through a door which is locked. There is a person, he says, who has a key. So he just sticks the key in the lock and he opens the door. And that's straightforward. And this is the Kabbalist. He has the key. He has the system. He has mastered the map, the divine map. And he knows where he's sending his Kavanot, his meditations up. But we are like people who haven't got a key, who've lost the key. Or in one statement, one variant, he says, like a robber, like a thief who wants to get in and the door is locked, he just breaks it down with something like an axe or a hammer. So we burst in. We don't bother with the precision of the discipline of the Kabbalistic Lurianic Kabbalah. We just aim our prayer, our intention directly bursting into the divine realm without using the map. So this is a kind of a translation of one type of religious experience to another, which is much more emotionally charged and which relies on the kind of a spiritual force of the individual to achieve what a discipline of scholarly mastery would have required of the more traditional Kabbalists.
You mentioned before the opposition to Hasidism, and particularly the ways in which this opposition was productive for the development of the movement. Could you briefly describe what the opposition was towards Hasidism? And perhaps the moment that we talked about before was 1772, and the ways in which this sort of opposition afterwards either continued and whether or not it was productive for the movement in the same manner.
Okay, I think the opposition certainly gave Hasidism a sense of itself as a phenomenon, as something that unites different individuals who operated in some connection with one another, but certainly not in a coherent way, and certainly not as any movement that has its own agenda, that has its own program and its own mechanisms for implementing it. The opposition made them think, well, they look at us as if we are one group and as if we have got a certain subversive agenda. What can we do about it? And the reaction of the group of Hasidic leaders, who we know from one letter by Reb Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the founder of Chabad, we know that they gathered together as soon as it happened in the spring around Pesach time of that year at the court of the Maggid of Mezrich, very shortly before he died, in order to take advice, to consult together. We don't know how many of them were there. A group of them were there. We know the names of a few of them. But that is the first initiative I can see of a group of Hasidic leaders who had operated each in their own locality independently of one another to come together and devise a strategy together. And their strategy is very much appeasement. They try very hard. They have the highest regard for the focus of the opposition, who is Elijah the Gaon of Vilna, perhaps the highest, the most venerated scholarly rabbinic authority in the whole of the Ashkenazi world at this time. And the reason why the Gaon of Vilna chooses to oppose Hasidism with such vehemence and to try so desperately to eradicate it, I confess, ultimately, I don't yet understand fully. I can only say that my impression is that he is the focus. And if he had not chosen to come out against Hasidism, I don't believe there would have been a campaign of mitnagdim against Hasidism. He clearly believed that it was heretical and dangerous. It is tempting to believe, and certainly we have a few direct statements to this effect, that he regarded Hasidism either as an offshoot of the Sabbatean heresy or as something very much like it, that is too close to it for comfort. He certainly is said to have said a few explicit statements to this effect, and the writings of the mitnagdim during the whole period of the campaign and the polemic against Hasidism by the mitnagdim, which begins in 1772, and the Gaon of Vilna dies in 1797. The campaign goes on for a while afterwards, but eventually dies out as an active kind of belligerent set of actions. It is a complete failure, because even if you compare the different texts of the bans of excommunication, for the lack of a better word, the charamot that were pronounced on the Hasidim in different localities at the instigation of the headquarters, as it were, of the campaign in Vilna, you can see that they are actually quite uncomfortable with the strictures recommended by Vilna, by the Gaon, and they are much more modified. They try to set the Hasidim apart, to stop them from participating in certain communal occasions, but they are much more pale by comparison with the language of the original text that we have initiated by the Gaon of Vilna. And the fact is that they are not successful. Far from obliterating Hasidism, Hasidism continues to spread and, in fact, grows and spreads much more rapidly. And you can see that Hasidism could not be described as a subversive sect. Hasidism, in many respects, was compliant with the halakha. There were a few areas, distinct areas, in which they broke from the halakha, most notoriously the times of prayer, delaying the times of prayer so that shacharit is not achieved until midday at the earliest, mincha is in the evening, and God knows how arvit goes on until the small hours of the night. And time and again, this is mentioned as the deviation from the norm. But on the whole, they were compliant and in some respects even stricter than the mitnagdim were, for example, in the ritual slaughtering. The kind of heretical ritual slaughtering of the Hasidim, as it were, was in fact stricter, simply stricter than the ordinary. And the quarrels about the ritual slaughtering spread within Hasidism itself, because one group would not even recognize the strictures of another. There are very few deviations from the halachic norm. It is nothing like what happens in Sabbateanism, or certainly in Frankism, where transgression becomes a mitzvah. Far from it. And basically, the Hasidim were part, they were part of the flesh and blood of the Jewish communities. They did not rise up against the institutions of the Kehila. On the contrary, they infiltrated it. They joined it from within and ultimately managed to achieve a majority and running the community that they kind of conquered. But they never confronted it. They never were out to demolish the corrupt rule of the Kahal. So Hasidism spreads and Mitnagdism fails. And I would add to this that certain historical events during this period actually serve Hasidism very well as a mode of expansion and stop the Mitnagdim from succeeding in effecting the aim of putting an end to it. And that is the complete fragmentation of the whole region during this period. Hasidism emerges, as I argued at the very beginning, in a very non-centralistic way. Different groups of people, very loosely affiliated with one another, not yet a coherent movement. And its mode of expansion was further and further decentralized, non-centralistic expansion. So more and more Hasidic groups, each with its own leader, operating independently as leader to his own followers, over larger swathes of territory and over larger numbers of people. Mitnagdism didn't benefit from this political fragmentation of Poland we have during this period, the partitions of Poland. The first partition of Poland happened to coincide with the year 1772, and by the end of the century, there's no longer a Poland. Hasidism and Mitnagdism both emerge on a landscape which is politically very fragmented and had not been centralized for quite a long time. Hasidism benefits from this. Mitnagdism suffers from it because the Gaon of Vilna, as we know, did not actually hold an official rabbinic appointment. He was completely an independent scholar, venerated by everyone and by the leadership of his community, but not officially charged with running even his own community, let alone any other community. So when these letters are sent by the Mitnagdim, urging other communities to do as they have done, they have no force. They depend entirely on the willingness of local communities to comply. And as I said before, they comply half-heartedly, and some don't comply at all. And they have no authority, no power, because they have no central power. At most, Vilna would be perhaps under the control of the Kahal there. But each Kahal was independent and could do what they wanted. The Council of Four Lands, which at one time exercised certain, even that never free from tension, centralized authority, had stopped, was dysfunctional since the mid-60s of the century. So the same conditions that enhanced the growth and expansion of Hasidism in fact contributed to the failure of the Mitnagdic campaign.
Let's turn for a moment to the sources you use. As I mentioned before, one of the great innovations of your work is the ways in which you reframe sources that were well known, and particularly around your discussion of hagiography and the use of sort of veneration or biographies that seem to be not good historical sources. And additionally, you mentioned also about the teachings that were recorded and written down by students. So in your writing about Hasidism, what sorts of sources did you use? What sorts of challenges did you face in using those sources?
Well, the challenge of dealing with the teachings is a challenge that we are stuck with because we cannot go back. We don't have recordings. You know, it is a very different situation from the current situation where the deceased last Rebbe of Lubavitch is still, you know, speaking to his audience. His recordings, you know, there are hundreds of recordings that were brought up, the video recordings, so you can hear every word he says if you can understand them. It was very difficult to understand but nevertheless, we have it. But for the 18th century, for the 19th century, we don't have the actual verbatim record, and we are stuck with that, and we have to do the best we can. As I said, I think earlier on, sometimes by juxtaposing different recensions of the same material by different disciples, where you can sometimes try to arrive at what is the closest approximation of what was actually said, but we'll never know. As for the legendary biographies, for which the model is the Baal Sheh, Shifrei HaBesht, and Shifrei HaBesht, after an interval of about 50 years, is followed by a whole cluster of hagiographical works about all other Hasidic writers, about the Baal Shem Tov himself, new tales modeled on the old. That the problem there also is ultimately impossible to resolve. But what I try to show is that despite the tendency, on one hand, of pious believers to take literally every word written in it as if it was historical fact, and on the other hand, of skeptical scholars to dismiss the whole thing as just a fanciful invention, the material that is historical and can be verified, that is embedded in that text, and sometimes in the later works that we have, can be very valuable historically, particularly when it is offered incidentally, when it is not the actual point of any particular tale, but where it is just scattered incidentally as kind of anchors in the development of the narrative. And these incidental remarks about practical facts of daily life can be verified sometimes when they're compared with external sources. And you can see that the aim of the tale is not to falsify. It is to ultimately to edify, to strengthen belief in the sages, in the chachamim, which is the word they use, but it is emunat chachamim, it is belief in the powers of these charismatic leaders, to strengthen altogether religious belief and practice at a time, after all, at which we also have the Haskalah emerging, and increasingly in the course of the 19th century, all kinds of modern secular threats. So that is the main purpose of these tales. And it is there that they can go fanciful. But when they're talking about material or, you know, simple facts, which they're not particularly interested in preserving because they have no interest in them, they are scattering little authentic anchors that can help us locate particular stories in a particular context and work out how much of it can be verified. And I contrasted this with the kind of project of writing the history of Hasidism that emerges from within Hasidism, which presents itself as a modern historiographical project by adopting some of the mannerisms of scholarship, namely recognizing that whereas at the time when Shifrei HaBesht first came into being, first as a manuscript assembled by an editor probably at some point in the 1790s based on oral tales that were circulating amongst the Hasidim themselves, and eventually when it is published in 1814. At that time, it is clear that historiography is not something of any interest. What is interesting is strengthening faith, edifying, but recording historical events and facts is completely uninteresting. It is there incidentally, but it is not the aim. In fact, there's a long tradition of certain contempt for historiography. You know, this is, as the Rambam said, you know, this is something that Gentiles do. They write about battles and, you know, we have better things to do. I mean, this is a very crude presentation of their position, and there's a lot of historical material that is written into other genres. But the writing of historical books is not something the Jews did very much of. Historical books as such, historical chronicles after catastrophes, a few exceptions, but certainly it's not a noble occupation. And in fact, the editor and the publisher, both the publisher and the editor of Shivre Yabesh, apologize for appearing to be writing a historical book, which has little value, whereas and stressing that in fact their purpose in writing these historical narratives is to strengthen faith. Now, the Hasidic project of writing history, and there I focused on the very notable and huge enterprise that is associated with the penultimate leader of Chabad. This is Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, who begins at some point in the interwar period, for good reasons, and I'm a great admirer of him in every respect, but as a historian, he very cleverly mobilizes the idiom, the modern scholarly historiographical idiom. In other words, he recognizes that oral traditions are not accepted by historians as reliable historical sources. You have to have written documentation. You have to have really solid, if possible, archival documentation. That's what historians value. And so he adopts a style of writing and these mannerisms. He has footnotes. He has documentary sources on which he bases his historical reconstructions of early Hasidism, early Chabad, and offers them as the kind of the narrative that captures the essence of Hasidism. It is the kind of the foundational narrative, historical narrative of Hasidism. And I was able to show that this is based on recognition in the value of documentation that finds the collection of what we now know is mostly forgeries produced possibly for the same motive at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, most likely just before the First World War, a collection of documents that was discovered in mysterious circumstances in the Ukrainian, East Ukrainian town of Kherson, just lying in the street, in the gutter. And thousands of letters purported to be written by the Baal Shem Tov, by some of his colleagues whom we know from the legendary biography of the Baal Shem Tov, by the Maggid of Mezrich, by some of his disciples, documenting the life of the Baal Shem Tov and all his associates at a time at which we know nothing about them, you know, long before he becomes a public figure and during that figure. And these are his anchors, his historical anchors. He refers to the Cherson Geniza explicitly as his source, long after he already knows that some clever scholars, within a relatively short time, within less than a decade of the appearance of this treasure trove of documents, which at first was greeted with great enthusiasm, we finally have actual documents about the very beginnings of Hasidism and its great leaders, was shown to be a forgery. The motivation for the forgery, as I said, is not entirely clear. It could have been prompted by the need, by the desire to strengthen Hasidic tradition with the kind of tools of the people who criticized it, and that is the historians who were so dismissive of the value of these historical traditions the Hasidim have in their own legendary books. But it could have just been the desire to make money, because by that time, such a discovery had a value on the book market, and a lot of people were selling what they could. The collection was divided, fragmented, bits of it were sold in different markets. A very large collection of it was actually bought for the Lubavitch court, for the predecessor of the Sisson Mor, for the fifth, for his father, Shalom Dov Ber, who apparently, according to his son, insisted that they were authentic, even after it was discovered when fragment corners of some of the pages on which these letters appeared were sent to a laboratory test somewhere in Switzerland, and the test revealed that the paper on which these letters were written could not have been produced before the middle of the 19th century. So that was embarrassing, but certainly the Chabad court continued to endorse them as authentic, but said simply that the letters that were found were just copies of the originals, but there's no question that they are authentic. And that remains the position of Chabad to this day, even though some people within Chabad, the late Joshua Moonshine, for example, and some others, I think know perfectly well that these are not authentic, but they are kind of committed to it by the endorsement that was repeated time and again by the sixth Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, for whom it was very important. It was a very important tool in his attempt to reclaim Hasidic history, to take it out of the hands of the secular historians, and to really fight their assertions with their own tools.
Let's continue on with a collection of essays, and actually in something that segues to your second book, and that is the role of women in Hasidism and the Hasidic court. Can you help describe exactly what it was that you feel is the role of women, and why this collection of essays that you have, these four essays in the second half of the book, was such an intervention in the historiography of Hasidism?
Well, I think at the time when I first began to think about this question, there was nothing in the literature. Hasidic scholarship in the world in which I was working simply ignored the topic as lacking any interest or validity. Even the one chapter, short chapter by Horodetsky in his 1923, I think, book, Hasidut VaHasidim, which was obviously known to scholars, did not attract particular attention, was not taken seriously, I suppose. I think the general feeling was that there's nothing much to say about this. I first was drawn to thinking about this when I came across not only Horodetsky's chapter, but even more surprisingly and intriguingly, by a whole flurry of publications in Yiddish and in Hebrew, and some even in English, from the 1930s, 40s, right up to the 60s, that celebrated the role of women in Hasidism, listing a number of women as great Hasidic leaders in their own right. And I was surprised because there was nothing to support this in the Hasidic literature that I was studying, that I had been studying by that time for a few decades. You know, where does this come from? Why is it that we have nothing about such women or nothing from such women in the corpus of Hasidic literature that we study? So I look back. I was able to see very soon that, first of all, Horodetsky's chapter in the book was based on a little article he published in Russian, in the Russian scholarly journal in 1909, and that there was a difference between the two versions. The version in the article was much more modified. It was a suggestion that Hasidism accords a great deal of respect to some women who are all related to the household of a male Hasidic leader, sisters, mothers, sometimes daughters, all of whom were normative women. They were married, they had children, but by virtue of their association with their male relatives, who were very famous Hasidic leaders, were granted a lot of respect and believed to have certain supernatural powers. And Horodetsky says that he collected his information about these women from old people in the Ukraine, in the region in which he himself was brought up, and he was brought up in a Hasidic milieu of the Chernobyl dynasty, and was I treat Horodetsky basically as a source more than as a history. He was recording things that he heard, things that he knew, and he says he heard old people who still remembered some of these women. Most notably and exceptionally, even in that chapter, the maid of Ludmi, the Tula, a woman whose life he describes very briefly as a girl who began after a certain crisis when her mother dies, and she kind of faints for a while, becomes very ill. When she recovers, begins to adopt the liturgical practices of a man, prays all day, refuses to marry, even though she was betrothed to a young man whom she apparently loved. She would have none of it. She says, a soul of a male tzaddik has been transmigrated, incarnated in her, and that she is from now on going to devote herself entirely to study and prayer. And soon enough, people begin to flock to her, and regard her as a Hasidic leader in her own right. Horodetsky describes this as unique. And eventually she's forced to marry on the advice of Reb Mordechai of Chernobyl, who is brought into the case because the kind of local leadership is embarrassed by this phenomenon of a woman leader. She's forced to marry, but she refuses to consummate the marriage. She's forced to marry again, refuses to consummate it. Apparently, the magic is dispelled once she's married and her following abandons her, and she ends her life in the Holy Land and dies there, apparently in complete anonymity. There's nothing about what happened to her in Eretz Israel. The story is developed and fleshed out in the chapter that Horodetsky wrote more than 20 years later, when he, by that time, as I tried to show, he had been exposed both to Zionism, which has in it a very clear feminist strand, you know, egalitarian feminist strand, more in theory than in practice, but nevertheless there very much. And he has also been exposed to Jewish feminism, the beginning of Jewish feminism in Berlin, because Horodetsky left his Ukraine birthplace, traveled and studied in Europe, in Switzerland, he was in Berlin. He is exposed to new strands of thought that embrace a form of feminism, egalitarian feminism, and projects that into his treatment of the same topic in the chapter in the book, in a way which was completely lacking in the original article in Russian. And it is clear that he was one of those Jewish Zionist thinkers who believe, and he's not alone, that Hasidism can offer a viable model for the rebirth of the Jewish people on its land, viable because it is authentically Jewish, it came from within, as opposed to various other ideologies that come entirely from outside. And so for him, Hasidism, with its feminism, becomes a very important agenda. And that is what is very present in his treatment of the subject. Now, his book became very popular, and I was able to show, I think, convincingly, that virtually all the subsequent treatments of the topic in popular books, in journalistic accounts, in anthologies of newspaper articles published by Yiddish writers in Poland in the interwar years, by Hebrew writers, and some fictional works, very famously, were fascinated by the story of the Maid of Ludmir, and basically had practically no other information than that provided by Horodetsky originally, but they flesh it out and develop it. And so the story acquires more and more details, including some, and I'm convinced that they are not anchored in any authentic tradition, even though some purport to be, about her running a Hasidic court in Jerusalem and people flocking to her. There's no trace of that in the Jewish press of those years. One would have expected, particularly the journals that were active in Eretz Israel at the time, Chabatzelet, you know, not a word about this anywhere. No marking of her date of death, or if she had been a public figure in Jerusalem at the time, we surely would have found something about it. It's such a striking phenomenon. I really believe that she died in anonymity. She does appear to feature as a real historical figure, and I have no doubt that she did attract a following for a while until it was suppressed or quashed by the local male leadership under whatever circumstances, through her marriage or not. But there was there are two references to a woman that sounds very much like her by name, by place of origin, Ludmir in Berlin, who features in the list of the widows of Jerusalem in the 1860s and 1870s that appear in the censuses that Montefiore commissioned of the Jewish population of Eretz Israel. And I discovered it thanks to a graduate student, an American graduate student, who stumbled on it and drew my attention to it. And more or less at the same time, the author of the beautifully written book, The Maiden of Ludmir, Nathaniel, this is old age senility, please don't include it. Nathaniel Deutsch, also, I think, at about the same time, discovered it quite independently. I published it as an appendix to a Hebrew version of my original article. He includes it in his book. So I believe that she was a historical figure. And in fact, I believe that there may have been other women like her. But to me, the significant fact is that the Hasidic movement chooses to pass over this incomplete silence. And I refer to it as a thundering silence, because if it was something that Hasidism was capable of assimilating, the phenomenon of female Hasidic leader, we would have heard something about it. But they choose to completely pass over it in silence. They don't have the conceptual tools to integrate it into their worldview. And it is only in the 20th century, and more so as feminism, Jewish feminism and Orthodox feminism take force, that this becomes a very popular topic. And it features in all kinds of apologetic accounts about the prominence of women in the Jewish tradition. You know, it's not true that this is a patriarchal system. It is not true that it is misogynistic. Look, it also has these Jewish women leaders admired by all. Now, when I first wrote this article, I think it started slowly, but it did start a whole new debate about the topic. And a number of people responded to what I said by modifying the picture somewhat, by stressing a feature that I did not conceal. I also addressed it, but giving it much more information and strength, that even though it is true that a type of female leader, such as the Maid of Ludmir, namely a woman who chooses celibacy, which is anathema to rabbinic tradition, there's no particular spiritual value to being a virgin. A virgin is just an unfortunate, incomplete woman. You know, if she doesn't manage to marry and procreate, she has not fully matured, as it were. It is a tragedy, but it is not a religious value for a woman in herself. It is occasionally for a man, but certainly not for a woman. These women certainly were not a legitimate model. But the other model of the married mother who is related by close family ties to a major male Hasidic figure was indeed treated with tremendous respect and credited with the power to perform supernatural things. Her blessings were sought rather like the blessings of male tzaddikim. People submitted tzetlach for her. She offered a pidyon, you know, a ransom. She offered to mediate on their behalf in much the same way as the male tzaddikim. So they're never these women. Tzaddikim refer to a tzaddikim in their own right. They're never treated as such, but they come as close to it as a woman can. And so I modified somewhat my categorical assertions about the fact that women were totally excluded from the spiritual life of the Hasidic court, although I still do believe that effectively they were, because ultimately women are not present when the Rebbe delivers his teaching. They're not present at his tish, at his table. At the very beginning, I argued, Hasidism offers an alternative to a family life where there are women and children, because the Hasidim, the pattern of affiliating with Hasidism, consisted of leaving home for extended periods, sometimes months, usually at the times when the presence of the man was most necessary in the household, during the festivals, during Shabbat. And the men would have an alternative spiritual family, which is entirely male, a fraternity, where all the rituals of celebration, which entail a meal around the table, were recreated in this purely male environment. And to a certain extent, this is still true. I have some evidence of more recent Hasidic courts where women are not part of the Seder celebration. They celebrate the Seder separately in their own room. They're not part of the family celebration. They're ultimately displaced by the female presence of the divine at the table of the male participants. But this is by no means universal. So the picture that I drew to begin with in a very kind of strong way has been modified by more information about these eminent women who are not full-fledged tzaddikim, but who are related to them and have quite a lot of power, by other avenues that women had for exercising power. But these are always women who are closely related to the household of a male leader, daughter-in-law, widow of, very rarely wife, usually the widow of a great Hasidic leader, or the matriarch, the mother of the reigning Rebbe, would have a lot of power in determining. Nehemiah Poland has shown how much power they had in deciding on the succession, which son would be the successor of a particular Rebbe at a particular court. So more and more people have also highlighted the prominence of women in the tales. The fact that they are even mentioned, you know, and this is natural because the tales are describing daily life and women are present in daily life, but the women are often credited with virtues. They're never the virtues of a Rebbe, but they're the traditional women virtues of being charitable, being generous, being pious. So the picture is complex, and I became more interested in the recent years, having satisfied myself that women are not made to be Rebbes, to be tzaddikim, and that the Maid of Lubmir is perhaps the exception that confirms the rule, or the Maid of Lubmir and other women who may have existed like her, but about whom we know nothing. These are the exceptions that confirm the rule, that this is not a legitimate model, but there are many women who conform to the legitimate model. And what became more interesting to me is what is the nature of the affiliation of ordinary women, the wives of the Hasidim, the daughters of the Hasidim, to the movement. And this is what really propels the two papers in this collection that deals with the relationship of women to the court, women to Hasidism, consciousness of belonging to the movement. On the test case of Chabad, which is the one I've studied most, it is the one which has the richest literature published and is also very accessible. So looking at the Chabad case, I try to show how a female constituency of women who are identifying themselves with the movement, in contrast to the kind of connection they would have had with it in the 19th and certainly in the 18th century, which was much more precarious and much more indirect, how it comes into being and how they graduate from being at the time of the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Again, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, whom I mentioned in connection with the hagiography that pretends to be historiography. He is also a great innovator, as he is in every respect, in terms of the space he creates for women in his flock, the recognition of women, first by just mobilizing them as Orthodox activists at a time of crisis for Orthodox Jewry, when the threat of desertion into the secular world is very serious. And finally, in the late 30s, he begins to even open up scope for women to be introduced to the mystical teachings of Chabad, of Hasidism. And this is a trend that is enhanced a great deal by his successor, the last Rebbe, who is the first one to actually incorporate women as a collective, as an organization in its own right within Chabad. And this is Neshei Uvnot Chabad, the women and daughters of Chabad. And I'm deliberately translating Neshei and Uvnot, Nashim and Banot, not as wives and daughters, but as women and young girls of Chabad. I'm sure that that is how it is to be understood.
You had mentioned previously in the opposition towards Hasidism, particularly by the figure of the Vilna Gaon in the late 18th century, that there was a comparison of the burgeoning Hasidic movement to a previous movement, the heresy of Shabtai Tzvi. And I think this is an interesting transition to the second book under discussion, which is your book, Women in the Messianic Heresy of Shabtai Tzvi. So I was wondering if briefly you can give a little bit of background about Sabbatianism. What was it like and what sort of context did it exist in, and what was its opposition?
Okay. I mean, Sabbatianism begins as a kind of a messianic, an eruption of messianic expectations of instant or imminent redemption around the figure of another charismatic. I mean, this is Shabtai Tzvi, a Jew born in Smyrna, Izmir, in 1726. He's a strange young man, begins to study Kabbalah on his own, which is unusual, without a teacher. Is particularly fascinated by two Kabbalistic works, no others as far as we know, the Zohar and Sefer HaKanah. Maybe say something about it later. And he apparently proclaims himself the Messiah after performing a whole series of weird things, pronouncing the Tetragrammaton in public, which is not to be done, behaving a bit strangely, and ultimately is driven out of the town by the rabbinic authorities as a madman, basically. And he embarks on a period of travel through the Greek islands. We don't know exactly where he was or what he was doing until he finally encounters the man who becomes his prophet, Nathan of Gaza, who recognizes his face as the face that he, in a vision, had seen on the divine chariot in a vision he had, and tells him he is the Messiah. So confirms such messianic sense that he had himself. Sabbatai Tzvi himself is portrayed as a not particularly stable personality. He needs this confirmation. And so Sabbatai Tzvi proclaims himself finally publicly as Messiah in 1665, in the winter of 1665, in Izmir, and is greeted with tremendous enthusiasm. There's a little bit of opposition, a little bit of resistance to this in some quarters, but this is quickly wiped out by the wave of popular enthusiasm. Why the public would have been so receptive to this message there's a whole range of explanations, and I won't go into them now. But the movement quickly takes on and spreads throughout, effectively, the Jewish world. And we have evidence of this not only from the intense correspondence, and we are dealing with a period when means of communication are fairly good by the middle of the 17th century. So letters travel back and forth, broadsheets are published, read out publicly in the synagogue. The news spreads very rapidly. We have a lot of evidence that non-Jewish observers, wherever it came, wherever it reached, noted it and reported it and published their own, sometimes simply curious, sometimes hostile accounts of it. And Sabbatai Tzvi emerges as the messianic figure in an environment to begin with, which is predominantly Sephardi in practice, even though it is really an old Byzantine. He himself is an old Byzantine Jew, a Roman yacht. But there are many, many, many ex-Marano Jews, conversos, who have returned to Judaism during the whole of the 16th and first half of the 17th century, moving into and within the Ottoman Empire, settling his own town of Izmir, which is a port town, has a very diverse population of Jews from all over the place. It is a society that is much less confined by solid tradition. It is a society that had undergone several traumas and is experiencing a great deal of migration during this period, so perhaps is more receptive to new messages and new practices. At any rate, Sabbatai Tzvi, supported by the prophecies of Nathan of Gaza, who is a tremendously effective propagandist for him, acquires an international reputation But the end of a year in 1666, he is arrested by the Ottoman authorities, suspected of subversion because there's too much upheaval going on in the Jewish population. And apparently this is looking like it might be politically dangerous. And he is eventually forcibly converted within that period of his incarceration, converts to Islam. And you would think that this might put an end to the whole upheaval and enthusiasm, but not so. Although some people abandon their faith and realize that this is a false messiah, significant numbers of people, and we don't have precise figures, but it is clear that the movement keeps going. And Nathan of Gaza is very ingenious in interpreting the act of conversion to Islam as part of the preordained mission of the Messiah, who is descending to the abyss of impurity that is represented by Islam in order to extricate from it the particles of divine light, using Kabbalistic language, that are trapped within it and that would keep it alive. And once he completes his task and releases all the divine energy that is entrapped within Islam and sustains it in existence, it would kind of dwindle away, as it were. It will come to an end, and the whole world will be redeemed. So this message enables the movement to go on, and it goes on everywhere, in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, in the Levant, in North Africa, in the Yemen. It is astounding how worldwide it becomes. And a small group of people follow Sabbatai Zvi in conversion to Islam while retaining a distinctive identity as Sabbateans, as converted Jews. And the majority remained Jewish. In other words, the transgressions performed by Sabbatai Zvi and the ones he calls upon the believers to follow suit in do not include compulsory conversion for everybody. They include the sort of transgressions that, and there was a wonderful article published not long ago by Maoz Kahana showing how most of them can be explained as following very precisely the inner logic of the halakha for messianic times. So they're not defiant transgressions for the sake of nihilistic release from all boundaries, but rather very carefully calculated to answer the need of messianic times in terms of the halakha, so the abolition of the fasts that mark mourning for the destruction of the temple, because there's no longer any need to mourn it, because the temple is about to be rebuilt and the sacrifices to be restored, and so on. So the movement has tremendous longevity and vitality, which marks it out by comparison to all other messianic episodes, and there have been many in the history of Judaism, which on the whole tend to remain local and to be short-lived. Once the messianic expectation is proved to not be fulfilled, the thing dies out. And here it doesn't die out, and it survives into the 18th century. And in fact, the title of my book uses a landmark 1666 as the year of Sabbatai Zvi's conversion, when the movement really becomes a heresy, and 1816, which is the year in which it is also an arbitrary date, but it is the year in which Eva Frank, the daughter of Jacob Frank, who is perhaps the most powerful successor, if you like, or kin, but very different type of messianic figure that emerged in Poland in the middle of the 18th century. And this is his daughter, who in the last 20 years of his life, he actually presents as the female messiah. So the whole movement has struck me, and I tried to show, has embedded in it from the very beginning an ideal of female liberation, a kind of an egalitarian, gender egalitarian agenda, which is not consistently and coherently articulated, although we have a wonderful short record of what appears to be an authentic sermon or preach or kind of speech by Sabbatai Zvi in Izmir addressed to women, in which he promises to liberate them from all their sufferings as a result of the sin of Eve. He's coming to annul the sin, the primordial sin. He's coming to make women as happy as their husbands, equal to their husbands in enjoying the redeemed world that he's bringing into effect. So he has got this idea from the very beginning, and this is Sabbatai Zvi's idea, if we are to trust the evidence, which comes to us from a rather hostile Dutch observer who was present and heard it and seems to record it as close to verbatim as we can believe. We never know, but I think on the whole, this is a usable piece of evidence. And subsequently, there is evidence of this agenda, never consistently implemented, not everywhere, but it runs right through from the beginning, right up to the end, where you have the figure of the female Messiah as construed by Jacob Frank. So this is what attracted my attention. And I went, even though Scholem, the author of the monumental study of the Sabbatean movement, without which we would have not be anywhere where we are today in terms of our knowledge of this, Scholem was aware of most of the evidence about women in the movement. And yet his verdict was that they were insignificant, that they were not particularly important, and they played no particular role in the shaping of the Sabbatean movement. I came to the conclusion that women, on the basis of the evidence assembled, can be shown to have been granted unequaled equality in terms of their ability, the recognition of their power for spiritual revelations that they are sharing with other people, to be recognized as prophetesses, to be functioning effectively as leaders of sectarian groups once the movement after the apostasy of Sabbatai Zvi gradually moves underground, to be playing a full part in the whole project, studying Zohar, being taught Zohar. There was a definite agenda of teaching Zohar to women in the original, if possible, and if they don't know the Aramaic or the Hebrew, to teach them in translation, in Yiddish on the one hand, in Ladino, and we have translations that were being used for this purpose and descriptions of sessions in which men and women sit and study together or have private tuition in the Zohar. Women, teachers are hired to teach the daughters of the household Zohar. We have women becoming the focus of pilgrimage for local populations that are there to hear their messianic revelations about Sabbatai Zvi and who effectively trigger the emergence of a messianic enthusiasm in particular localities. They're the first ones. Sometimes they're the ones who actually persuade the men that the messianic messages are authentic, are true, and should be obeyed. So I was overwhelmed by this discovery, and I kind of argued that if there ever was anything remotely like a feminist agenda anywhere in pre-modern Judaism, then it was not in Hasidism, where it has been said, and I try to argue that this is a myth, but it is in Sabbateanism, and it is significant that it is so anomalous. It is heretical. It is something that grows within an environment that steps away from the world of rabbinic values, rather than Hasidism, which ultimately stays very much within it. And in fact, I argued originally that Hasidism excludes women as hermetically as it does, simply because it is being conservative. It conforms to traditional gender norms that govern Jewish rabbinic society from the early centuries of the Common Era and to a certain effect even to this day. Whereas after I became acquainted with the material in Sabbateanism and came to the conclusion that something very different is happening here, I revised my view and argued that very likely Hasidism was retreating consciously and horrified from what it witnessed in the spread of Sabbateanism, even in Poland, at the same time and in the same regions as Hasidism was emerging, because the prominence of women in Sabbateanism was viewed by rabbinic Judaism, generally by the people around them, above all, as evidence that once you let the women loose, once you have them studying prophesying, leading communities, you have a complete collapse of the prohibitions on sexual relations. You have an eradication of the gender boundaries that are so deeply embedded in the whole halakha that make it a very clear separation of what is for women, what is for men. But once you knock down these barriers, you have licentious behavior left, right, and center. You have people behaving immorally as it was perceived. This was the one thing that became a hallmark of the Sabbatean heresy. And I think it became that above all because of the prominence of women within it, the fact that women are an integral part of the messianic community in all the different sectarian groups and other manifestations of Sabbateanism that I could see wherever it happened. It doesn't always take the same form, but it is present there right through, sometimes richly documented, sometimes just alluded to. But I think when you put all this evidence together, there's no doubt that this is the case.
To continue with this theme, and in a sense, link the two books under discussion today, could you briefly reflect on the relationship between Sabbateanism and Hasidism? On the surface, both are movements interested in Jewish spiritual renewal in the Eastern European setting. And in your books, you argue in different ways for the centrality of women to both movements.
Yes, I mean, this is a question that has been hotly debated. I mean, Scholem and his students generally were inclined to the view that Hasidism emerges really as a dialectical reaction to Sabbateanism. So it is very close to it, but it is defining itself in reference to and sometimes as a modification of attenuation of some of the features of Sabbateanism that became discredited through the movement. Most notably, Scholem argued that the figure of the tzaddik, the charismatic, the emergence of the charismatic leader as the key to Hasidism is a modified version of the messianic prophet in Sabbateanism, or the messianic prophet come messiah, as many of them were. Both they begin as prophets and assume a certain dimension of being the messiah himself, sometimes even divinized in one form or another. So to Scholem, this was, and the question of the descent of the tzaddik, which is a feature of Hasidic teaching, the tzaddik has to descend to the level of, well, how low is the debatable. Sometimes it is stated simply to the level of ordinary people from whom the tzaddik is very different, as I stressed earlier on. Sometimes it is even right down to the realm of evil, to experience it in order to function effectively as a mediator for ordinary people or people who are trapped within the material evil world that we inhabit. So Scholem suggested that this feature of the Hasidic teaching is in itself a response, a modified response of the descent of Sabbatai Tzvi to Islam, to conversion, or the transgression that became inherent in the Sabbatean conception of the law of messianic time. This was rejected by some scholars, notably by Mendel Pietras, who is a very important scholar of Hasidism, who argued that one can arrive at the Hasidic notion of the tzaddik and of the descent of the tzaddik completely bypassing the Sabbatean episode, which he believed was not as important as Scholem had made it. And so Hasidism was not reacting to Sabbateanism, but was developing independently its own set of teachings. Now, my own feeling is more inclined towards the Scholem position, that there is, on several scores, a certain continuity by way of reaction. And very notably, I thought, and that is the conclusion I came to in the end, in terms of the position of women. Certainly, if I needed one more area in which one could say Hasidism is a reaction to, or a modification of, in this case, clearly a reaction, not a modification, to Sabbateanism, then the retreat from female spirituality that marks Sabbateanism as a novelty, as something that is recognized for the first time in a way that I'm not familiar with before or after, that this feature of Hasidism, in fact, is one more piece of evidence to strengthen that interpretation.
I would like to thank Professor Ada Rappaport-Albert for joining us on the Jewish Studies channel of the New Books Network. We've been discussing two of her books, The first, Hasidic Studies, Essays in History and Gender, published by the Lippmann Library of Jewish Civilization in 2018, and her book, Women and the Messianic Heresy of Sabbatai Tzvi, published by Lippmann Library in 2011.